Greetings and blessing to each one of you again this morning. Very much appreciated the service, and it's worthy of each of the segments is worthy of some comments, but I'm not going to take the time to do that. I did really appreciate the singing, and brother, you're correct. Your favorites are also my favorites, and several of them, at least one of them, very special to me. Jesus Keep Me Near the Cross is a song that my mother sang on her deathbed 21 years ago, and she had no strength to do anything else, but she did start singing that song, and it's a blessing to me. Glimpses of Faithfulness, 1500 to 1968, and is the title for this morning. And if I moved at 15 miles per hour with 1500 years last evening, I need to move at about 55 for the next 500 years. So I am going to have to move rather rapidly, but yet I do want to keep you along with me. So my thoughts went to Deuteronomy 32. I think I'm going to hold that until the end. Maybe I'll read just one verse, and then I'll close with the ending verses. Remember the days of old, verse 7, Deuteronomy 32. Remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations. Ask thy father, and he will show thee, thy elders, and they will tell thee. For the Lord's, verse 9, for the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. God has been faithful to his people. We saw that last evening, and we're going to continue to see that this morning. But we want to start at 1500. And the question I want to start with is why, and this is not going to seem like a regular Sunday morning service sermon, because it is a history lesson. Tomorrow, or this evening, I want to try to bring last evening's message and this morning's message together into more of a practical pointers for us today and where we can go from there. But for this morning, this is going to be more or less a history lesson. Well, my question is, why did things start to change around 1500? And it's interesting. If you study history, you can see this happen. And there's some things that enabled this, some changes to happen in the world. And this area of time is known as the Reformation. And we talked about one of those things last evening already. The invention of the printing press was one of the keys that started to unlock the Dark Ages. Another one was a Renaissance. And this was just simply men who allowed themselves, who made a choice. I appreciated the emphasis in the lesson this morning on choices. And we're going to see that in each of my 17 points. Is it that many? Well, however many it is. There was choices involved. But the Renaissance was simply the choice of men to think outside of the constraints of the box that the Catholic dogma had placed on society, an outside pressure placing on society for many, many years. There was a sad state of affairs in mainline churches, and it prompted these men to look outside of that. Plus, God was working. This was God's timetable. In the fullness of time, the scriptures say God brought Jesus into this world. In the fullness of time, it was time for him to come. And I believe it was in the fullness of time here that the Reformation started happening. Now, point number one, and what this morning is simply these points are characters or events. Just looking at characters or events that happened in these 500 years. Number one is Ulrich Zwingli, born in 1484. He was a reformer in Zurich, Switzerland. He was influenced by Martin Luther. We could spend time talking about him, but we won't do that. But Ulrich Zwingli, as he began to study the Word of God and he began to preach it in Zurich, he preached it with power and he preached it with authority. He preached it honestly and openly. And the city of Zurich, the city council, was right there with him. And he had under him, he had a group of men that would sit and listen and participate. These men were men we're going to mention later, Conrad Grumbel, Simon Stump, and Felix Mons, and others who sat at him and just amened him on. And they started changing some things. They abolished infant baptism. But as time went on, the city council of Zurich started pulling back. And they started hesitating. And guess what? Ulrich Zwingli started hesitating too. You see, he was one of these from the sacral society that we talked about last evening. We're society, and I explained that, how Tyrone would be a Catholic town, a state college would be a Protestant town, for example. It was a monolithic society. It was the whole religion and politics, the civil society, was all wrapped up into one. And that's still the way he looked at life. He could not understand the Rottengeister, if you were here last evening, you know what I mean. He could not understand the people who saw that and wanted to pull away from it. Because of the scriptures, come ye apart, or come out from among them and be ye separate. And that's where the break started to happen. That's where the fissure started. There's other Protestant movements. Martin Luther already mentioned the Lutherans, John Calvin. His followers became known as the Calvinists or the Baptists. Zwingli, zero. Zwingli died on the battlefield. His followers, there is no Zwingliites. Possibly the Anabaptists, his influence on Conrad Grebel and others did follow through, but there's no Reformed church today that traces its roots directly to Zwingli. Church of England under Henry VIII, this Protestant movement gave birth to the Anglican Church, the Puritans, and the Pilgrims, not us. This would be the Puritans, the Mayflower, 1620, and all that. Number two, Conrad Grebel, born in 1498. I already mentioned he studied under Zwingli, but before he did that, he was a richly talented young man. He was a Catholic university student, and he was not interested in spiritual things. He went to college to have a good time. By 1520, he was bitterly discouraged. In 1521, he met a girl named Barbara and fell in love. He called her his whole world and referred to her jokingly as his barbarity. But he started questioning things, and he was influenced by Zwingli, by Zwingli's preaching. He was one of these that sat under him, and he became converted. And his writings after 1522 show the change. He was a changed man. But Grebel was part of this group with Felix Mons and George Blaurock, who were an embarrassment to Zwingli. And the break happened. He broke with Zwingli on January 21, 1525. And this is the account where Conrad Grebel, I believe, asked George Blaurock to baptize him. I might have that turned around. I could read it here, but I don't think I will. And that baptism, they each rebaptized each other and ordained each other to be preachers of the gospel. And this happened January 21, 1525, at the beginning of the Anabaptist movement. The modern day, well, I shouldn't say the modern day Anabaptist movement. Like I said last evening, it's not quite correct to say this is the beginning of the Anabaptist movement. It is in a narrow way, but the Anabaptist movement, the Weidertaufers, go back. The Cathars, they go all the way back to the time of the apostles. There's always been a people who separated from the false church, and united around the faithfulness of God and a faithful church. Number three was Michael Sattler. He was another highly educated man. He was a monk in the Roman Catholic Church. Again, he studied to be a priest, but was disillusioned with a sinful life and united with the Swiss Brethren in Zurich. He's remembered because he wrote the Schleitheim Confession of Faith. And if you, the Anabaptist movement was fraught with many dangers. There was, as any movement is, there's a tendency to go to this extreme, there's a tendency to go to that extreme. We're going to look at some of those extremes. This confession of faith, which confession of faith have done, there's, we'll talk about one other this morning. They are there to unite the brotherhood around some certain goals and aspirations and important doctrines. And this is what he did. As part of his defense for the Anabaptists, he wrote this Schleitheim Confession of Faith, which made him a marked man, the most dangerous man in Zurich, as far as the Zurich council members. And he was put to death very horribly. And there's vivid details given in Martyr's Mirror. Very, very horrible death. But quite a testimony, Michael Sattler. Number four is Munster. And the first 4 points here, or the first 3 points, dealt with the Anabaptist movement in Switzerland. We go now to Holland. The Anabaptists also started coalescing. The movement started in Holland about the same time, and they were not really related. There was not conversations going back with brethren saying, hey, let's get something started here. And this in Holland and in Switzerland, it didn't happen that way. They came up, they came up on their own. But we switched to the Dutch Anabaptists, and this starts with a man with the name of Melchior Hoffman. And this is a painful point. This story is a dark stain on the history of the Anabaptists, and it needs to be looked at as an aberration, or not. This was not the standard. The city of Munster was a city, obviously, and Melchior Hoffman. Well, let me back up to Melchior Hoffman. Anabaptism started under his influence in Holland. He was an eloquent man, an extremely a man that could move audiences. He had that way of communicating, but he was given to extremes. He was not a full Anabaptist, but he did associate with them. He put a lot of stock in visions and revelations and gave fanatical interpretations to the book of Revelation. It seemed like that was his primary focus, the book of Revelation. At one point, he even thought he was Elijah, or the reincarnation of Elijah, one of the witnesses. He had a strong influence on thousands, but on particularly two individuals. Now, we're going to talk about the one first, and then I'll go into the second. But the first one was John Mathis. John Mathis took Melchior Hoffman's extreme fanaticism and made it even more extreme. John Mathis was evidently mentally, ethically, and spiritually imbalanced. There's no other way to say it. But in February 25, and this happened in the city of Munster, February 25, 1534, he somehow got power, and I don't know how that was. He got the power. He gave out the order to execute all the godless in the city of Munster, and he did give them a day of grace to desert the city before he massacred them. And I'm not sure how many he did execute, but of course these people exited the city, some did, the Catholic bishop of Munster became very alarmed and laid siege to the city. So you had, this is like warfare. Mathis was deluded into thinking he was a second Gideon, went out to fight the bishop with troops, and was badly outnumbered and slain on the battlefield. But there was another man, an even more extreme and fanatical than John Mathis, another man with the name of John, proclaimed himself king, lived in splendor. Meanwhile, because of the siege that the city was starving, it was horrible. They ate rats, they ate shoe leather. Meanwhile, King John lived in splendor. He made a rule that men should have more than one wife, and he did it himself, encouraged others to do the same. By June 24, 25 of the next year, it lasted a whole year like that. The city was betrayed to the bishop's forces, and King John and two of his leaders were captured, put to death. Their bodies were hung in iron cages high on a church tower. For 50 years, the skeletons were there. After 50 years, the skeletons were taken out, but the iron cages are still there. In the city of Munster, if you Google iron cages in Munster Church, you will see pictures high up in the church tower. You can see these three cages. I assume they've probably been replaced through the years, but there's still cages there. That's one. Melchior Hoffman had one influence on this Munster incident. And like I said, if you Google Anabaptists and you study it from a secular perspective, you will come across this incident. This incident goes down through history as part of who the Anabaptists were. Now, it's not fair because this is not who the Anabaptists were, but it's a lesson we can learn that every movement has its tendency to go to extreme. It does. We'll say more about that probably this evening, Lord willing. Another influence from Melchior Hoffman was Obie and Dirk Phillips. Now, this is the good influence. He was baptized, Obie Phillips was baptized by John Mathis in 1533, but soon broke from John's extreme views. And Obie Phillips was very, very much like how we understand the Bible today as traditional Anabaptists, except for the doctrine of incarnation and shunning. The Amish practice even today of shunning stems back to Obie Phillips and the Dutch Mennonites. They were severely persecuted. From 1531 to 1597, 2,000 martyrs gave their lives, and three-fourths of these were Mennonites. Notice I used the name Mennonite. At some point here, the Mennonites were, they started be called Mennonites. But there's sometimes we have the understanding that severe persecution is one of those things that provides unity in the church, and that's not the case. The Dutch Anabaptists were severely persecuted, but that did not prevent strife and party the strife and party spirit from developing. They split and splintered and split and splintered. Three branches developed: the Waterlanders, who favored a mild discipline. Maybe you could say they were very moderate, more liberal in their thinking. Then you had the Flemish on the other extreme, were very, very strict, and the Frisians were somewhere in between. Those were the three main divisions, but each of these, the old and new Flemish, the strict and moderate Flemish, and they just, from there on out, there was many splinters. They even split over a bishop's house. The bishop's house wasn't quite up to specs in some ways, or was too fancy or whatever, and it made splits and splinters. And that you might grin about that, but the Mennonite churches in Lancaster, or in Pennsylvania, in United States in the past 50 years, there's been a lot of splintering here too. You all realize that, but persecution is not the cure-all to all churches' problems. I want to say that very. This history proves this out. The Dordrecht Confession of Faith was formed here at this time period to help resolve differences and bring churches together. And the Garden City Confession of Faith, which we use this morning, comes from the Schleitheim and the Dordrecht. Number six, Menno Simons, as a young man, was baptized by Obi Phillips. He was ordained, but before that he was ordained by a priest. And as he was doing his priestly things, we talked about transubstantiation last evening and how he would administer the bread and the wine, and he, as he was doing that, he started realizing that it didn't line up, that his whole thought did not line up with the scriptures. And so finally, the events at Munster and a man in a nearby town being beheaded were enough to make this cautious man step forward and take leadership. And it was a pivotal point in Dutch Anabaptist history. They finally had a leader. Obi Phillips, while he was a great thinker, he was not really a leader that the Anabaptists needed at this time. But God did provide a leader in Menno Simons, and we bear his name today. Number 7, Tieleman J. Van Brought, the writer and compiler of the Martyr's Mirror. Just want to mention that. This is the time period of that. It should be in your homes. Number 8, the Palatinate. It was an area north of Switzerland. And so as the Dutch Mennonites were severely persecuted, and as the Swiss were severely persecuted, one of the areas they migrated to was in northern Germany. Not northern Germany. It was north of Switzerland, southern France. It would be considered, I believe today, or what was considered during World War II, the Rhineland. But the Mennonites went into this, migrated. There was some more freedoms in this area. They also settled in Moravia, which would be the Hutterites, the Danzig area in Prussia, not far from present-day Ukraine. These were also areas in Europe where they were settling as they were being pushed out of Amsterdam and Zurich, cantons in Switzerland. The Meidung. How many know what the Meidung is? Meidung is shunning. This is where I want to talk about the Amish. The shunning was a practice of avoidance that originated with the Dutch Anabaptists. I already mentioned that. Obi Phillips stood for this doctrine. It's New Testament. They take verses in the New Testament where it says, no, not to have company with them, and build upon that very, very strongly and include some things that we don't do today. Some Amish do practice the shunning. But it started, the Amish church started with a man, with a young, rather headstrong bishop named Jacob Almond, started pushing for this practice along with semi-annual communion, which was not done in Switzerland. Conflict erupted, and you have church leaders excommunicating other church leaders. Jacob Almond expelled bishops who didn't agree with him, and some bishops he didn't even know. It split the Swiss churches, some going with Almond and some staying with Hans Reist, the older bishop. This was the beginning of the Amish church, 1693. There's only two divisions in the Swiss. That's how they're very different than the Dutch Mennonites. Dutch Mennonites splintered over a lot of things, but the Swiss, there was only two, the Frohlich division and the Jacob Almond, 1693. Number 10 is Germantown. We are moving. Well, I said they moved in the Palatinate, but during this time they also began to look west. They began to look toward a new world. Although the new world was first talked about back Felix Mons, George Blaurock, that was already talked about back in the 1520s about going to the land across the seas where the little red men live. That was talked about then, but it wasn't until 1600s that they actually started going. Germantown was the first significant permanent settlement of Mennonites in America. This was 1683. First Mennonite minister in America was William Rittenhouse. He was ordained about 1690. An outgrowth from Germantown was a skipack school where Christopher Dock taught. These are Mennonites who were pushed out of the Palatinate, out of other areas, migrating north. They went north in the Rhine River. They most of them exited through Amsterdam on ships, some stopping in, going across the English Channel, stopping in England, and then going across to the New World. What's interesting about Skipack area and the Mennonites in Germantown, just a side note here, the first American protests against slavery came from the Skipack Mennonites. It was not some political organization in the 1840s and 50s. And this is predates even the Constitution, the Revolutionary War. I don't have a date for that, but it was the Skipack Mennonites who first started writing out against slavery. The Mennonite churches in this area became the Franconia Conference, which by now is wrapped up into Mennonite USA, but up until the 1980s anyway, the 1980s were known as the Franconia Conference. There might be some of you sitting here who have Franconia Conference background. In fact, I know there is. And so, this time period is very crucial. Just a little note here. As they made the transition, I'm not sure how to explain this to you, but if you can picture in your mind living in a persecuted society that wanted to persecute you. Now, by this time, there were not too many losing their lives. In fact, in the city of Zurich, there was only 40 that we have record of that actually did die for their faith, Swiss Anabaptists. There's probably many more than that, but I should say Bern. This was the city of Bern, which was close by. A lot of us, the names I mentioned last evening at the beginning of the service, a lot of those names come from Bern. And a lot of us have our history goes back to that town. But it's hard for us to understand these people. Or maybe not hard for us to understand, but it's hard to it helps us maybe to understand what they went through as they were a persecuted people and they had to leave and they went to the New World. And I wish I had time to read an account of someone who wrote it all out, the sea travel and finally getting to the New World. And it was so open and so free. There was a lot of transitions that took place here. The Anabaptists became Mennonites, or first they were called Menes. The Suffering Church became the Suffering Church, the persecuted church, became the agrarian, quiet, basically unmolested and undisturbed church. Now, there were some times of tension. It was the French and Indian War had quite an effect on the Mennonites. Some of the they didn't quite know how to understand and deal with all this. They were free. So Washington needed wagons to haul his provisions out to Fort Necessity to fight the French. And Mennonite farmers went along driving their horses and wagons. They did. They weren't sure how to make this transition. This was a free land. What all should the Mennonites do? What all should a separated people do? They understood the concept, but it took them a while to adjust, and there was mistakes made. I don't want to gloss over this and make it sound like they were perfect. Today we would not be troop carriers. We would not, our men, young men would not drive troop carriers, even though they're not involved in the actual conflict. They would not drive the transports and man ships and submarines. Humility became more or less the defining characteristic of these Mennonites, which led them to become the quiet in the land. I wish I could say it in German. Some of you here maybe are German, but the phrase is die Stillen in der Lande or something like that. That was the real tendency. Well, we want to talk more about that tonight. Is it? Maybe I'll just leave you with a question. Is that what Mennonites should be? The quiet in the land. They had a tendency just to go to themselves and become their own little thing. No one was disturbing them. They just became like their little communities. Franconia Skipback community. The the Hans Herr Lancaster community, the community up around Shirksville. Are you all familiar with that? There was the northern areas there. Number 11, Hans Herr. I need to be drawing this to a close, and I have a lot to go yet. But Hans Herr was the part of the first group of Mennonites who traveled to the frontier. This was in 1711. They settled on prime land between the Pequay Creek and the Conestoga River. They spread rapidly to other areas from here, but Hans Herr's son Christian built the house that is now the Hans Herr House in 1719 near Willow Street. How many were ever there? Raise your hand if you were at the Hans Herr House. Okay, a couple hands. Well, they came in four great waves. The Mennonites came from the Old World in four great waves, mentioned very briefly here, 1709 to 1751. There was 3,000 to 5,000 came to Eastern PA by 1775. Second migration, 1851 to 1861. If you notice, these took place in times of peace, and they were not over war times. 1851 to 1861, they came and settled in Western PA, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa. This was the short span between the Napoleon conflicts and the Civil War, 1851 to 1861. Number three, third great wave, 1873 to 1880, they came from Russia, which is a link I had missed earlier. I think I'll maybe get to that. But they came from Russia to the western states in Manitoba, and then immediately following World War II, the Russian Mennonites came out of Russia to Canada and South America. Catherine the Great, I think I'm just going to mention her name. I don't have time to say as much about this as I want, but there's a whole history of the Russian Mennonites. Catherine the Great invited the Mennonites to come settle in Russia, and they did. She promised them freedom from war, and this was a time period of a lot of wars. And the Mennonites were weary of staying out of the war, staying out of conscription. A lot of Mennonites went to Russia, but then had to leave because of the communist takeover in 1917. They went from there to South America, Western U.S. and Canada. You have names like Reimer, Clausen, Dick, etc., that these were Russian Mennonites. And some of them are with us today. Number 14 is Barbara Hershey. Barbara Hershey was a young lady who was dating. Her boyfriend's name was Enos Barge. They were crossing the railroad tracks in Burdenhand, east of Lancaster, in 1896 while they're on their way home from a wild party. And yes, they were Mennonites. They had not joined the church yet, but this was a time period of the Mennonite Church. Again, this is not something that is viewed positively. The Mennonite Church went through a stage here where they were very lax in teaching spirituality. And a lot of the young people did not join church until they were married. But she and her boyfriend were crossing the tracks and were killed by a train. Not sure how it happened, that they didn't see it. But they were crossing the tracks, train hit them, they were both killed. There was, like I said, the church life was not what it should have been. The Mennonite Church at this time was facing some pressures, and it came from the West. There was Mennonite men who studied at Moody Bible Institute, and became Protestant. And their theology, there was Protestant, I shouldn't say Protestant in their theology, but there was Protestant influences coming into the Mennonite church, like revival meetings and Sunday school. There was a pietistic movement here, which was good, it was needed. But there was some, especially in Lancaster County, who were very resistant to change. I don't want to be cautious with that. It's good to be resistant to change, but we have to be open to the right kind of change. We have to be open to pietism if we're becoming legalistic. And that's what was happening here. There needed to be something, and it seemed like God allowed this incident to happen here to wake up the Mennonite church out of its complacency. And faithful leaders were stood in the gap and said, and allowed good change to happen. There was good things that did result of this. This is sometimes called the Mennonite Great Awakening in the late 1800s and early 1900s. If you would look at some of the pictures of your ancestors who were married in this time period, they may have looked, the pictures may look like completely non-Mennonite. They wore ties and the ladies wore gowns, and it was, if you would, I'm not sure what that would be for you, great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents. If you find the book, I Hear the Reaper's Song, it gives the account of all this. It's very easy to read. It's in story form, but it was a time of transition for the Mennonite Church to realize that they needed to become spiritual. To holding on to just traditions is not enough. You have George R. Brunk, who was a bishop in the Mennonite Church. He was born in 1871, lived until 1938. I think you all have heard that name already. He was ordained minister at the age of 21 in Kansas and a bishop at the age of 26 in 1898. He was an extremely gifted, outspoken leader and uncompromising in defending the Mennonite Church against its many foes. So he was not a perfect man. He stood for some things that we do not stand for today, but for voting for one. Now, he started the Sword and Trumpet magazine periodical. He was the editor of it for many years. But liberalism was coming in from the West. I already mentioned some of that. The Moody Bible Institute, General Conference, Mennonites in the West were liberal, more liberal in their theology. Modernism was coming in. Modernism was influencing the church, and I don't have time to go into all this. But he was a bulwark of conservatism to hold the line. And this was in the early 1920s. This was a time he was actually able to shut down Goshen College for 1 year. Goshen College was pulling in professors who were educated at European colleges who were not Mennonite, who were not Christian. They were pulling these in, and it was changing. And he was very influential. Read Faithfully George R. That's a good book if you want to learn more about George R. Brunk. Number 16 is Daniel Kaufman, contemporary of George R. He compiled the Gospel Herald, and he wrote the Doctrines of the Bible. Oreo Miller, number 17, born in 1892, was an unordained lay brother. But he had a very much influence in the Mennonite Church in the 1920s and the 1960s. He was a missions man. He traveled all over the world, meeting with world leaders relating to relief efforts. He helped to found and served on the board of MCC, Mennonite Central Committee, for many years. He was a very influential man. He was known as a peacemaker and compromiser, especially in floating between the East Conservative Lancaster Conference and General Conference and the Franconia Conference and the Virginia Conference, who were known as the more conservative conferences, and floating between them and the Western Liberal General Conference. He was able to mingle freely, and it's interesting to me, one of the ways that he dressed was he wore a plain suit, but underneath the plain suit he had a necktie. It just gives a perfect picture of who this man was. And I'm not saying his influences were all bad, and he did a lot of good. I respect, and he deserves respect for that. But there was a side, there was something about that did some harm as well. He may have contributed to the worldly modernistic trends of the Mennonite Church, especially in the 50s and 60s. This leads me to point number 18, the conservative movement. Because of these changes, because of the liberalism that was coming into the Mennonite Church, you have the conservative movement beginning in the 1950s, starting with the Riverdale congregation in Millbank, Ontario. Is there anyone familiar with that congregation? Okay, I see one hand. Riverdale congregation in 1956. This was before my time. Some of you would have been living over this time. And right now, I should probably turn it over to Bob High or someone that can talk about this with maybe more authority because they lived through it. But other congregations, other small separations followed. Congregations are parts of congregations identifying with the nationwide fellowship. This was in the late 50s. It was out of this, these men that came the conservative publishing houses. Rod and Staff started in 1959 with Paul Landis, and Christian Light Publishers in 1969 by Sanford Schenck. And it's hard to overemphasize the tremendous blessing this was to the small group that needed again to separate. Is this so much different than the Anabaptists backing up 500 years ago? It might be slightly different, but it was a group that recognized that God's word was being tampered with, obedience was being lost. And when you can only do so much of that till you're at one again with the state church. And these brethren, Paul Landis, Sanford Schenck, and others. On July 17, 1968, the Lancaster Conference accepted the revised discipline which allowed television, among other things. Disappearance of the covering and cape dress had disappeared by this time. The ladies were wearing cut hair, and divorce and remarriage was accepted and allowed. That very day, Bishop Homer Bomberger submitted a letter of resignation. By the next 4 weeks, Bishops Aaron Schenck, Isaac K. Sensenick, and Benjamin C. Eschbach also resigned in that order. The result was the formation of the Eastern Pennsylvania Mennonite Church, out of which Pilgrim Conference came in 1992. That brings us to where we are today. And God has been faithful to his people. Glimpses of faithfulness, a line of faithfulness. I do want to read now, at closing, Deuteronomy 32, verses 7 through 15. Remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations. Ask thy father, and he will show thee, thy elders, and they will tell thee. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, and I realize this is talking about Israel, but I want you to be thinking about it from what we just talked about. He set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land, and in the waste, in the waste howling wilderness, he led him about, he instructed him, he kept him as the apple of his eye. As an eagle stirreth up her nest, fluttering over her young, spreadeth abroad her wings, taketh them, beareth them up on her wings. So the Lord alone did lead him, them. And there was no strange God with him. He made him ride on the high places of the earth, that he might eat the increase of the fields, and he made him to suck honey out of the rock, and oil out of the flinty rock, butter of kine, milk of sheep, with fat of lambs and rams of the breed of Bashan, and goats with the fat of kidneys and wheat. Thou didst drink the pure blood of the grape. A picture of the Mennonites coming to the new world, having all the blessings. But I need to read verse 15 yet. But Jeshurun waxed fat. Jeshurun is a word, a personal word for the children of Israel, a personal word of peace and blessing. But God's people waxed fat and kicked. Thou art waxed fat, thou art grown thick, thou art covered with fatness. Then he forsook God, which made him and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation. I just leave you with that warning. We want to take up the theme of faithfulness this evening, Lord willing. I want to leave you with that warning that God has blessed us so much. But let us not wax fat. Let us not disregard this line of faithfulness. God bless you. Thank you for your interest, for your attention, and come back praying for this evening. Let's kneel for prayer.